Hi, and welcome to a new episode of Ethics for a Changing World. We often hear the argument that technology itself is neutral, and that the ethical issues arise with how we specifically use the technology, not in the technology itself. Today, I'm going to be talking to Dr. Stephanie Hare, who's recently written a book entitled Technology is Not Neutral. We're going to be talking about why she thinks that. We're going to be talking about lots of other things as well. We cover a lot of ground in this episode. We're going to be talking about where we draw the line, at what point something stops just being convenient and starts to become creepy, and who gets to draw those lines. Facial recognition. We're going to be talking about social media and how we can effectively deal with social media companies. There have been a lot of suggestions about breaking them up, but we're not really sure how effective that would be. So we're going to be talking about that. And then finally, we're going to be talking about what we as individuals can do in the face of the challenges of AI, and conversely, what we as a society need to do to prepare individuals for those challenges. If you enjoy the podcast, and I really hope you do, then be sure to leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and to subscribe wherever you're listening to this, and share the show with friends or anyone who might be interested. You can find more content that we produce on Twitter at EthicsTechPod and on Instagram at Ethics for a Changing World. Without further ado, on with the show. Hi Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us. Could you just start by telling us a little bit about your own work?
Hi Patty, thanks so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to talk with you today. My work, I am a researcher and a broadcaster, and as of last month, an author of a book called Technology is Not Neutral, A Short Guide to Technology Ethics. So my work as a researcher is kind of an interdisciplinary approach. I look at technology, but I also look at political risk and history. I trained as an historian, so I bring a liberal arts and humanities and social sciences perspective to political risk and to tech.
Awesome. That sounds really interesting. And we'll pick up on a few things there. So the title of your book, as you mentioned, is Technology is Not Neutral. Could you just explain to us what you mean by that statement?
Sure. So it's kind of a play on the first chapter, which asks it as a question, is technology neutral? And I divided it into two teams. There was Team Technology is Neutral, which was a group of some of the top thinkers and doers, if you will, if I can use that word, in technology today, who, you know, believe quite strongly that technology is neutral. Any ethical questions in terms of whether it's good or bad are purely a function of how people use it, right? So it's humans who decide whether or not technology is good or bad based on how they use it. And then there's a different team, Team Technology is Not Neutral, who completely disagree. In their view, and again, these are some of the top thinkers and doers, so it's really fun to pit these people against each other, like in an academic debate. They think that everything about technology is a question of values, from who is coming up with the ideas, who gets funding for the ideas, and who does not, and who's on the teams that build the technology. You know, that's not neutral. Those are overwhelmingly some demographics and overwhelmingly not other demographics, right? So like right there, we start to see it. But even, you know, the raw materials that are sourced can become an ethical issue very quickly. Some of the rare earths minerals, for instance, that we rely on for most of our hardware are coming from China or the Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC. So, you know, high conflict zones with really terrible human rights records and depression in the case of China. If you're sourcing from there, if you've got your supply chain dependent on that in any way, shape, or form, that's an ethical issue. So they take ethics and really sort of embed it through every stage, you know, hardware, software, design choices, team composition, all of it. And so the chapter kind of plays these two teams off against each other, and then it takes us back in history to apply it from a historical perspective, so that we don't think that, you know, just because things look like they're crazy today, it's not necessarily new. It's just like the latest iteration on an old problem. And sometimes it's helpful just to kind of see how did scientists, for instance, approach this when we were looking at the Second World War and the creation of the atomic bomb, for instance. Like, they had to come up with an ethical position on that as well. So the idea was really, for me, when I came up with the title of the book, to get off the fence, because there's nothing more annoying when people are like, well, it's really complicated. Let's just problematize this. That happens a lot, as you know, in academia, where you can just spend your entire life or career describing a problem. And that's a really important phase, but I wanted to challenge myself to go beyond that and get off the fence. So by the end of the book, I finally titled it for myself. My view personally is that technology is not neutral, but I didn't write the book to get people to agree with me. I'm really excited to hear people who disagree. I wanted more to invite people to ask the question, is technology neutral? And then work through the thinking themselves to come up with their own view.
So I guess some people might respond to that position, again, is just an example of tech being a function of how it's used, right? So the tech is just a function of all the stuff that goes into it, which is just a function of how that's extracted. How do you respond to that? How do you see that?
Well, I guess what I would just say is it's about being mindful of each design choice that you're making along the way. So if you've got an idea, right, for a product or a service or some sort of enhancement, maybe on something that already exists, or maybe you're wanting to create something new, you are that person with the idea. What happens next? So right there, you could be like, I have got the idea for the most like frightful, terrifying weapon of all time. Do I take that to someone? Who do I take it to? Who is going to be my financial partner to get that funded? Who's going to be the team that I want to build it with? What are our constraints? You know, where do we draw the line? What is inbounds and what is out of bounds? Who might we sell this to? Is there anyone we would not sell it to, right? And then, you know, and so on and so forth. What's the environmental impact of this? Are there any ways that this could be used that we haven't thought of, like unintended uses, unintended consequences? So I guess what I would say is, I think any time that humans are involved in creating anything, there are values, right, ethics that are being infused in them. And it's just about being aware of that. If you're fine with building those things, like, great, knock yourself out, go for it. But it's about waking up to that awareness and going, okay, actually, when I, you know, the food that I eat, the places where I'm shopping, I think we're all in this environment now where we are becoming much more mindful of all of the different choices we're making and that they have impacts down the line, but also impacts that we're not even aware of. Just because we're not aware of them doesn't mean those impacts don't exist and aren't happening. So I just wanted to apply that kind of intentionality and awareness to how we think about and use and create technology.
Yeah, I like that. I really like that framing because it applies a lot of the ways we've started to become accustomed to thinking about things to technology. And just to pick up on another thing you said, which was about the atomic bomb. And I think there's this tendency to think that we're in this uniquely challenging period with technology. What do you think we can learn from previous experiences like the atomic bomb?
Oh, it's so fascinating. I've got some great books that I read that are in the bibliography, and there's a full bibliography on my website for people who want the scary 170 page full bibliography. There's only a short version in the actual book because we wanted to save trees and not print the whole thing. But I really went hardcore nerd on my World War II and Cold War history, and even like history of technology in the Vietnam War, because I'm from the United States and Vietnam was an important conflict in my country's history. Scientists were having to take some of the same decisions that you often hear people working in technology, by which I mean sort of digital technology today. And I think learning that you're not alone, you know, that you are saying, what do you do if you don't agree with the policies of the government that your company or that your university or that you as a researcher, your research is now being used by your government? Right, so we hear this all the time today with things like AI warfare technology or building a search engine that could be used to censor search results, both of which are examples from Google within the past 4 years, for instance. So if you're that sort of young technologist figuring that out, it might be helpful and you might feel less alone to go back in time and learn what physicists were saying, you know, on their own in their journals, but also as a community, as a scientific community during the Second World War. And then after the US dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, a bunch of the physicists who had been okay with building the Manhattan Project because they thought it was so important to defeat the Axis powers, they saw the devastation that their work had wrought and, you know, had a change of heart or a view about, okay, going forward, this has happened, we can't change it. What do we do to make sure that these weapons are never used again? And it's not just physicists, of course, it's, you know, mathematicians who were involved in breaking encryption. It's chemists, you know, who from the First World War were involved in making killer gases, some of the first weapons to be banned, and biological warfare. Even botanists, you know, I've read this amazing book called, where is it? It's somewhere on my shelf. It's by Sarah Bridgers. It's Cold War Science, I think. It's something like that. It's an amazing book by Harvard University Press. And she talks about how even botanists, their research was weaponized by the U.S. Department of Defense, sometimes like 20 years after the fact, and was used to make Agent Orange, which of course wreaked such devastation in Vietnam. So like no scientist could afford to ignore these questions of the ethics of their research and how it might be used and where they personally drew the line. And I think computer scientists or anyone who's involved in software or hardware creation, but also designers, right? People who are doing UI and UX, or people who are working in social media and who are having to think about the information ecosystem and the reliability of information and how to combat misinformation and disinformation, training up our society to have greater data literacy skills. There's a lot we can learn from the past. You know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel here on technology ethics. There was like 70 years of scholarship and history and debate and discourse about it. And I personally found it really, really affirming and inspiring and helpful to see that others had gone before me thinking about this. I learned a lot from those scientists.
Yeah, I think it's really good to know that we're not entirely alone. There's a new set of challenges, mm-hmm. but they have their parallels. One of the chapters or sections in your book is called Where Do We Draw the Line? And I wondered if you could tell us about what you mean by what kind of line we're talking about here and how you think we should decide to draw that line.
The question is one that I hear every time that I've worked with my own clients or when I've given public talks to all sorts of different audiences. Everybody can kind of wrap their head around the question of, is technology neutral? And they can follow the debate if I present it to them and come up with their own view. But, you know, eventually we all have to stop debating because people have to eventually build something, right? Or sell something or buy something. You have to make a choice. And so that question, where do you draw the line, comes up a lot. And so I wanted to play with that. And it's really interesting. This question of the line comes up all the time in technology in particular. So I quote, you know, Eric Schmidt, who was formerly the CEO of Google, and he's now working with the US Pentagon. He talks about the creepy line and that Google's policy was to go right up to the creepy line and then not cross it, in his view, right? But when you hear what he thinks is the line and what Google thought was acceptable, you might personally think they totally crossed that line. And he also was like, you know, is it creepy? Is it crossing the creepy line to put devices and implant them in people's brains? Like right now, yes, it is. But, you know, maybe it won't be later when the technology gets better. So it's just to show that like that line and where we draw it is always moving. It depends on who you ask. And it's also, you know, the question of time. If you had said to people 20 something years ago, would you be comfortable live broadcasting from your house, putting pictures of your home, your children, yourself, your lunch online for complete strangers to look at and rate? I think most people would have thought that was absolutely mad. It's such a is a cybersecurity risk. It's a privacy risk. It's really bad for the kids who can't like meaningfully consent, whose childhoods are now like entirely online thanks to the grownups in their lives. So where we draw the line today is probably going to be different in 20 years time, just as it was different 20 years ago. And the people drawing the line will be different, of course. And I wanted to really be mindful of those generational batons that are being passed. You've got an entire generation of people who are digital natives, you know, who've grown up with technology versus people like me. I'm Generation X. So the first 18 years of my life did not occur online. I only got email when I went to university, first year of university. And that was very advanced at that time because my university was very good on computer science. So, you know, just to give you an idea, right? Like there's entire, you know, the baby boomers, like most of their life wasn't online. It's only been online in the past, you know, 10 to 15, 20 years max. They've got totally different expectations and understandings of privacy, but also very different levels of data literacy and being able to spot fakes, for instance, or fake news. So this question of where do we draw the line, I was kind of unsatisfied with it because I was like, well, hang on, who gets to draw the line again? Is it the people building the technology? Because that's a really narrow demographic, right? Not just in terms of like gender or ethnicity or sexuality or where they've been educated, but even in terms of geography, if you look at the major companies that are creating the tech that most of us use around the world, they come from a few countries. That's it. Right. So like if you're from one of those countries that is not part of that creation and debate process, you're kind of just on the receiving end. So this question of who draws the line is important, but also who decides when the line has been crossed, who has that power and who can do anything about it once, you know, we can all agree maybe that the line's been crossed, but then what? Who enforces it? And then this question of, well, okay, fine. If we've answered who, how do we actually draw it? Like, sorry, can we just take a step back? How do you decide if something is ethical or not? And that's where I wanted to really bring philosophy into the discussion. And I envisioned it like a Swiss Army knife. You know, if philosophy is a Swiss Army knife, you can open it up and there's six smaller component tools. Ethics is one of them, but there's five other branches of philosophy that if you know about them, you can use to help you strengthen your thinking, your critical thinking, and answer this question of, you know, is this technology good or bad? How do we want to use it? So it was really fun to bring some of the most like cutting edge tools and technologies and debates that we're having today into contact with one of the oldest methods for thinking that human beings have had. You know, philosophy has been around for thousands of years, and it's what sort of gave birth to the scientific method that many more of us are probably familiar with. But philosophy's got so much to offer. So it was really fun to make an interdisciplinary book for people to use. And, you know, the book itself is a tool. I hope it will be used by people who are trying to make decisions about what they think about technology and tools.
Yeah, I'm a really big fan of the interdisciplinary approach that you use. I'm just going to push you on one thing there, because you did say that at some point we have to stop asking the questions and start answering them. Who do you think should draw the line, and how do we make sure it's the right kind of people?
So I think we have to look at who the technology or tool will be used on, like who is going to feel the impact of it. And they have to have a greater role than I think they've been having in the creation process. So what I mean by that is this. For instance, you've got a lot of dating apps, right? People love to use dating apps nowadays and have been for a while, although there's a lot of people who've gone off them for exactly the reasons I'm about to elucidate. Some of them can be really creepy and gross, and it doesn't give people as much control, perhaps, as they would like to feel safe while using a dating app. So there's your problem. People want to date. How do you find people to date? An app could be an option for that. But how do you make it so that dating is safe? So who are the people that are going to be most likely at risk from a dating app? And that could be from like romance fraud, right? Where like women get defrauded out of sometimes, you know, tens, if not thousands, hundreds of thousands of pounds from scamsters that they've met online who are basically just con men. But it can also be like of a physical nature, like actual physical threat of date rape or the like, stalking. So how do you work with a vulnerable user group, which in this case could be women? It might also be not just women. So you'd want to think about that in terms of different communities. The gay community might have something else going on in terms of risk profiles that they would want to have factored into design, trans community as well, right? And so on and so on. So you could parse it along all those different groups so that they're involved in co-creating a tool and technology that's going to be out there to protect their communities. And that is something that doesn't happen, I think, probably enough. And I'm just giving that as one example. There's all sorts of examples where you might be thinking about tools or weapons, something that could have an environmental impact where you'd want to be really engaged with citizens in order to just understand the impact of the tool you're building. And the thing is it's so useful if you are a creator or a builder of, or a maker of a tool or a tech or a service, to talk with people. And I think that phase can be sometimes skipped over or rushed because it's seen as time consuming or expensive, but it's key. And if you can get that right early, you will save yourself any number of headaches down the road. It's a lot harder to fix that stuff post-launch than it is to factor it in early into the design. So putting ethics at the forefront of your design process, I think, is key.
Yeah, the example that made me think of is the recent case with Apple creating those. I can't remember what they're called, but these little coin-sized tags that you can use to track. And the idea is you could track an expensive handbag or a car or something, but they clearly didn't put enough thought into the dangers that were associated with that. And there's a lot of cases of stalking and issues like that.
Yeah, a perfect example. And the thing is, I'm sure the people who designed it genuinely had really good intentions at heart, because that's solving a very real problem. It is annoying when you lose stuff. It's super handy to be able to track it. But then you always have to, like, you know, get your most paranoid friends in the room with you to go, yeah, but it could be used in these ways. And that's what I mean about sort of widening your listening, you know, when you go on like a listening tour, when you're seeking input from people very early in your creation process, you want to have people who are almost like your doom mongers. How can this be misused? Right? Because if you're like a nice, sane, healthy person, you're probably not thinking about, you know, how could I take this wonderful idea I've just come up with and totally turn it into a nightmare? But unfortunately, there are people out there who will do that for you. Some of the most innovative people out there are your criminal nutter class. So you need to have a persona for them that's represented in your design process.
So I just wanted to move on now to, you wrote an article in Wired in January 2020, which was entitled "It's Time for AI Ethics to Grow Up," which is a great title for an article. And a lot has happened since January 2020, both in the world, obviously, but also specifically in terms of AI ethics. So my question is, has AI ethics grown up since then, and to what extent?
So I think it's growing up. I wrote that article because I had been to any number of panels and everybody was talking a lot. We were in like a real talking phase, I think in 2019 still. And what's interesting is watching now, or in 2022, there's people putting their money where their mouth is and actually starting to create funded programs, for instance, at universities. You've got people thinking about environmental, social, and governance in terms of finance and investing. So ESG has suddenly exploded on the scene in a new way. Now, whether or not, by the way, that's going to be yet more ethics washing remains to be seen, and greenwashing. But it's a factor, and it's there in a way that I think wasn't as much the case back in 2019. I think the media is reporting so much more. I mean, that's an area where I feel very encouraged. The media awareness, and thus hopefully the awareness in wider society, of artificial intelligence and its opportunities and risks and how we might need to think about it is much more advanced. There's a plethora of books that are being published on it by some really great thinkers. And that's, you know, percolating. That's percolating out into governments. The UK government, I actually think, is one of the sort of leading governments in the world in thinking about AI ethics. The US is trying as well, but it's just such a behemoth. You know, it's like a an aircraft carrier, that country. So to turn it in any direction can take a lot longer because it's just so big and populous and a federal system. Whereas the UK, by being smaller, so it's a little bit more nimble. So you see like government digital services and some of the other departments within the government are really hot on thinking about these things. So that doesn't mean they're going to get it right every time, but it's at least on their radar. It's on their map. It's embedded in their processes. And we've got a fantastic academic community here that is, again, also putting their money where their mouth is and funding things. So I think it's growing up. I wouldn't say it's grown up, but it's, I think, tracking nicely.
And you mentioned you said you're from the US and you obviously live in the UK. You wrote, I think it was 2 years ago now, that the battle over data protection will be fought and won over the next few years in Europe specifically. Why do you think Europe is so important here?
So the European Union is about, I would say, a similar counterweight to the United States in terms of population size and ability to set standards. So the US government will flex its muscle from time to time, for instance, by doing bans on certain companies through the US Department of Commerce. So we've seen that with the US government's approach to certain Chinese telecoms, for instance. And the US is also very strong in terms of its private sector, its companies and its universities, which is why Silicon Valley is a sort of byword around the world. The European Union also can be very effective with sanctions setting, but does suffer, I think, from the fact that it's got 27 member states who don't always agree on stuff in the way that the US government wants it. You know, decides to orient towards a policy, can just press go and go. That said, we saw with the GDPR a really powerful demonstration of norm and standard setting by the European Union that forced US technology companies, and indeed most countries' technology companies, to have to pay attention to and adhere to European values on data protection. So if we see the EU push ahead on things like the AI Act, which it's looking to do, and there's a couple other ones. The European Union last year in 2021 launched two landmark pieces of legislation, which is the Digital Markets Act and the Digital Services Act. Now, the DMA, the first one, that would allow the European Union to break up technology companies, or at least make them sell off their European operations if they were judged to be too dominant. So that's like a competition measure, but it would be huge, of course, in tackling tech giants. And then the Digital Services Act, the DSA, that would require online platforms to take down illegal content or counterfeit goods, or else be subject to substantial fines. If either of those two acts go through, much less both, those could be potential game changers in a way, you know, far more than the UK's Competition and Market Authority is setting up a digital markets unit to police technology companies' dominance. But the problem for the United Kingdom with the best will in the world on that is that they Brexited. We Brexited. So we're, you know, we have an angle to play, and I'm sure we're an important market, et cetera, but we do not have the same punching power that we did when we were in the European Union on that front. So I think if you're looking at things like, you know, the DMA, the DSA, or the AI Act, all coming from Europe, the United States cannot ignore those. It could potentially work around or ignore UK-only efforts.
And you mentioned this law that would allow the EU to break up tech companies. Based on your understanding, would that actually work? Because they're all American companies.
Well, that's what's really interesting. I don't think anyone really knows. We're in kind of uncharted territory here because these are not, I think it's more that they would have to break up their European operations, right? Which again, I think those companies will have game planned and done their scenario planning for. I'm sure they've got workarounds for it, just like when after the GDPR came in, to be completely honest, they moved a lot of data that had been housed here in Europe for people around the world. They moved it to the United States so that it doesn't fall under EU jurisdiction. So will they find ways to work around it? Probably, but will it be a real pain in the butt? Yes. So, you know, are we going to see, you know, the breakup of Facebook the way that you would see like the breakup of a big oil company? It's not going to, it's not something that you're going to be able to map one for one. It's probably more like taking little bites out of an elephant.
Okay, that makes sense. Interesting simile.
It's the only picture I could come up with. I'm clearly clearly hungry for lunch.
So another thing that you've written a lot about is concerns about facial recognition, and especially in London. Some listeners might be aware of this, but London actually has one of the highest densities of CCTV cameras anywhere in the world. You've written about concerns that London could become the next Orwellian surveillance city. Where are we at in terms of that? And are you still really worried about this going forward?
Yeah, I'm totally worried. I think London is mental. And the approach that the United Kingdom has to facial recognition technology, I just don't think most people are aware of it, which is why I wrote the book. So to give an idea, we are a United Kingdom. And we have laws about privacy and civil liberties and human rights here that in theory, everyone in the UK should be enjoying equally, regardless of where they live. This breaks down with facial recognition technology. There are some parts of the country that have gone really big on investing in it with the police, like London, where I live, has the London Met, which is a very enthusiastic user and tester of this technology and indeed integrated it permanently into its operations. By contrast, Police Scotland voluntarily, while working with the parliamentarians in Holyrood, decided not to use facial recognition technology because they think the risks for human rights violations are just too great. So they, you know, they put a ban basically on themselves. And so we're going to hold off for 5 years while we do further studies and, you know, just kind of come to a view. So how is that possible? Depending on where you live in the United Kingdom, your experience of the police and of this technology being used on you to identify you is totally different. Ditto over in Wales, where the South Wales Police has again been sort of a leader, if you could use that word, in using this technology and deploying it, not just live facial recognition technology at political protests and sporting events, but they've also got facial recognition technology being piloted on smartphone apps for their police officers. So again, if you're living under their jurisdiction in their area of operation, you're going to be having that, whereas somebody who is maybe 50 miles down the road will never have to encounter that. And you could say, who cares? Well, I'll tell you who cares. The regulators of this country care. They have all said, we need to stop doing this. I'm talking the surveillance camera commissioner, the biometrics commissioner. Those two jobs have just recently been merged, but they used to be separate people, both of whom were in agreement that this was going too far and needed to be stopped until we had a proper legislative framework in place. Ditto the information commissioner's office. Ditto the science and technology committee in the House of Commons, which point blank is on record in Parliament saying we need to stop using this tech until we have a proper biometric strategy in place. We don't have that right now, right? So like, it's really, you know, these are like people who in theory work for the establishment, and yet they themselves are saying we need to back off and just wait until we get a view and come up with something that's going to be appropriate in law. And we just haven't done that. And unfortunately, with this government, we've got an 80-seat majority for the current prime minister. There's not going to be any change. And I'm not actually sure that under Labour with Sir Keir Starmer, that he would want to change it either as a former prosecutor. So, you know, that to me is really concerning because of what's happening in terms of the ways it can be abused. It doesn't identify people accurately, equally across the population. If you've got darker skin, if you're a woman, you have a higher risk of being misidentified. And being misidentified by the cops is no laughing matter. Right? You do not want to have your facial biometric as an innocent person being stored in a database along with suspected and convicted criminals. But that's what's happening right now. It's been happening since 2012, and the Home Office was ticked off and told not to do it, and they've done nothing. because they said it would be too expensive to fix the database. Like, to me, that's just crazy.
Yeah, and there's a flip side to that. So there's this issue that it misidentifies certain people, especially certain groups of people. And there's also this danger that it is very good at identifying people. And therefore, you can imagine like people going out to protest and suddenly the police can identify literally everyone that's in the crowd, which previously was completely unthinkable.
Well, exactly. And I think people here in the UK might think, well, is that such a problem? Nothing to hide, nothing to fear. Well, being able to protest against your government, first of all, is a right. It's like part of your birthright as a British citizen. And indeed, most liberal democracies have that protected. So you don't have to explain why you should have the right to assembly and the right to free expression. You were born with that right. So anytime the government wants to interfere with it, they have to justify why that exception should be allowed. And what I would just say, and the book does go into this, is if you want an example of like, so what, why should I care? We are talking today, a week after Russia invaded Ukraine. And right now in Russia, people are protesting every day against this invasion. And the police can use live facial recognition technology to identify those protesters, and it can hunt them down after the fact, like in their homes. They were doing that before this invasion. That is described in my book. And now we're seeing a real-time example of the chilling effect. It's incredible the bravery of these people to even go and protest, because it's a criminal offense at the moment, and they will be tracked down and identified, and their entire network of, you know, family, friends, colleagues, neighbors, etc., can be mapped out using technology. So we might feel complacently here in the UK that that's not a risk for us. But I would just say, you know, I come from the United States, where only last year we had an insurrection where a group of people, you know, armed and dangerous, invaded Congress, the most powerful legislative body in the country and one of the most powerful in the world, and tried to overthrow the government, tried to stop the certification of a free and fair election. Right. So like, liberal democracies cannot be complacent against political risk, and these technologies can be used to suppress political expression that is legal and protected. It can also be used to hunt down people, hunt down cops, hunt down insurrectionists, etc. Like, it can be used either way. And that's kind of the point, is this technology is so powerful. And it's powerful when it gets it wrong, as in when it misidentifies people and puts them at risk in that way. And it's powerful when it gets it right and correctly identifies them, right? Because then you're living in your panopticon nightmare scenario. So it's a mess. It's not one of those things that you can just ignore and go, oh, I hope someone else will do the thinking on that and figure it out. All of us are going to have to get in on this one.
And what do you say to people who would listen to especially that Capitol riots example and think, good, I mean, no one's particularly sympathetic to the people that stormed the Capitol. And some people are going to be looking at and thinking, well, that's good for law and order. What do you say in response to that?
Well, first of all, I would say there's plenty of Americans, unfortunately, who are totally sympathetic to the people who stormed the Capitol and will likely try it again. So on that front, again, I think we just have to be really careful. We had a very close call in the United States in 2021, and that's not over. And even before that, we had people storming the state Capitol House in the state of Michigan, which is just north of mine, and basically did a dress rehearsal where they were going to kidnap the governor of the state of Michigan. And they went in with their weapons and occupied the Capitol building of that state, and nothing really happened to them. And that was, you know, a really great example of, if you don't stop people from doing stuff, they get emboldened, and voila, we get 6th January, 2021. And who knows what could happen in the United States this year. We've got the midterms coming up in November, and we've got a presidential election coming in 2024. So I would say that that is still a country that is in play. And these types of technologies, again, being used to organize protest against the government, but also just organize political activity in any sense, as general as you want to make it, those technologies will play a role for positive and for negative. And so I think the United States is getting a real wake-up call on that. We're obviously seeing it here in Europe with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but we might be seeing it in many other countries around the world as well. That's the thing, is these technologies are global factors now, and they're influencing political processes like elections. They're changing the nature of warfare, but they're also changing that relationship between the citizen and the state and consumers and companies. And also even us as individuals, you know, do you want to have surveillance technology such as an Amazon Ring doorbell or a Google Nest doorbell? On the one hand, it might be really convenient. Maybe people have been stealing your packages, or you just think it's a good personal safety device. But on the other hand, are you contributing to an increasing surveillance of our society? Maybe you don't care. Maybe you do. Maybe you've just never thought about it that way. And like, my goal isn't to tell people what to think. My goal is just to ask those questions and be like, what are we all, each of us, contributing to this? And the idea that you can sit it out and not be thinking about it, I think that's probably the one argument I would aim to destroy. By saying technology is not neutral, that means that all of us are going to have to get in the game.
So you mentioned this relationship between the state and the citizen and how this is changing. And we have this specific issue in the UK, I'm sure it also exists in other countries, about the collection and storage of people's biometric data. So that's often from facial recognition, not necessarily. And then it's stored by the state, and that could potentially undermine the idea that we're presumed innocent until proven guilty. Could you just explain to us a little bit more about this issue and how the relationship between citizen and state is changing?
Yeah. So on the one hand, you're right in the sense that, let's pick when you were born. And I referenced earlier that there's different generations who are all alive today who have really different data profiles. So if you're a baby boomer, if you're something like, I think 65 on up, most of your life has not been online. And you're probably not massively online even now. You might be on, you know, Facebook to see your grandkids or your kids, but you're not across all channels in general. I'm going to make really sweeping generalizations here. their kids, the Generation X kids, who are, you know, pretty much in their 40s on up, they're going to have the first 18 years of their life or so, roughly, completely in blackout, very little data collection on them. And then depending on how much social media they've been using, obviously, all of their work emails and personal emails from the minute they went online in the late 1990s to early 2000s, all of that's been kept and tracked and is being used. And then obviously, the younger ones, the millennials, the Generation Z, down to the little kids who are, you know, have just done 2 years of homeschooling on Zoom. You know, what's happening with all of that data, right? And they were the kids whose parents were like, oh, yay, we're pregnant. Let's put the ultrasound scan on Facebook. Boom, profile created, right? Like, these kids have had so much of their lives recorded online. And what privacy choices they'll be making as they get older will be really interesting. So on the one hand, imagine that governments and companies are just hoovering all this data up. It would be really easy to go conspiracy theorist and be like, they're doing stuff with it and it's really sophisticated. I'm not actually convinced that's true. I think a lot of them have it and maybe haven't actualized it yet. There will be others, though, who have. So it just depends on, you know, what kind of company we're talking about and what kind of government we're talking about. So anytime you want to get too worried about this, you can just be reassured by your spam folder. I mean, I get advertisements for stuff that clearly are not based on data profiling me at all. It's just random crap. But then there's the creepy stuff that does seem to follow you around the internet. And there's, of course, what governments could know about you, or very sophisticated banks due to third-party data brokers. I mean, there's a lot. I think if people really knew what was out there about them, they would freak out. They'd be a lot more careful.
And then I guess the issue that comes up then is, I mean, a lot of people are really worried about this kind of stuff, but what do you think we can actually do as individuals in the face of these kinds of challenges? It's very easy just to listen to specific examples of facial recognition and things like that and just be terrified. But what can we actually do as individuals in response to that?
I mean, there's a lot we can do. So first of all, like, don't underestimate your power. And again, I'm going to cite this as a person in a liberal democracy. I don't want to claim for a second that the risks are the same in other countries. But if you're living in a liberal democracy, you actually have quite a lot of power as a citizen, and you can be writing to your MPs, you can protest, you can be writing to newspapers or, you know, getting on podcasts, talking, just talking with your family and friends, making your commercial and consumer preferences known to the places where you shop, right? Like, people change stuff. We see people change stuff all the time in terms of their diet or recycling or the kind of packaging that they're really pissed off seeing their vegetables constantly covered in plastic, right? Like, are there, you know, the things we can do about that? Absolutely they are. And if you've got people you can throw out of office, then you can make yourself heard in a liberal democracy. You can also decide, it's like in sports, like in basketball, you know, do you play the ball or do you play the zone? So if you're like, I can't do all of these things, it's too much. Maybe you just want to focus on one local area, such as your child's school, right? And really make sure that, for instance, you're not using facial recognition technology to have your child pay for lunch in the school canteen. True story, here in the United Kingdom, in 2021, we had a bunch of schools using facial verification technology for kids to pay for lunch, which is, again, mad. Totally no need for that. And the parents at first okayed it. You know, they said it's fine. They gave consent. But then when people actually freaked out and went to the media and explained the risks, the regulator stepped in and we had a moratorium on it. Now, what we need is to actually have something on the law books that protects kids under the age of 18 and makes school a safe space so you don't have that type of tech ever being used on children. But at least they got that stopped and it raised awareness. And, you know, those stories were followed around the world. Everyone who works in data protection was looking at that and going, oh God, why are these companies trying to put their technology into our children's schools? So that's a great example of where parents were able to make a real difference at a national and even international level. So I would say it's that. It's like with any other area of your life, you have choices. You are designing your life all the time. And that doesn't mean that everybody has the same amount of power. Of course you don't. If you've got more money and more time, you have more options. But everybody can use the little bit that they can. And it's very surprising to me in an optimistic way how much impact one person can have or a community can have. So I would say, you know, claim your power if you can, if you can.
And you mentioned the AI community. I mean, something that I've found before I started making this podcast, I had absolutely no idea that that kind of community existed on anything like that kind of scale. But now I've started doing research, I'm more aware of it. But it seems to me like there's a very clear divide between kind of normal civil society that has no idea about most of the stuff that's going on. You get the occasional story in the media, but not particularly often. And then AI researchers who are absolutely terrified and who are working on this nonstop. What do you think we can do to kind of make more people aware of what's going on?
Well, I mean, we had the BBC Wreath Lectures in December with Professor Stuart Russell, who's one of the world's foremost experts on AI, and that went out on the World Service, you know, 4 free lectures that anyone could listen to from a top expert about different aspects of AI. So that's a great example of the BBC using its platform as a public broadcasting service to bring expertise, you know, to the people. I think a lot of newspapers actually are doing a really good job. But again, I'd sort of hold up the UK press, the Washington Post and the New York Times are trying as well. But I really think here in the UK, there's something kind of special going on that the journalists here are putting those stories on the front pages and discussing it in different ways. You know, so there's that. Is it on radio and television as much, or even on social media? Like, where do people get their news? And then are the AI ethics researchers or just AI researchers getting their findings to those people? If they only publish in, you know, peer-reviewed journals that are behind a really pricey paywall, nobody's going to read their stuff, right? So there has to be like an outreach component to their work. And I'm sure that they all, you know, feel they're doing that and are trying. There's only so many hours in a day and we've all been working in a pandemic and people have kids and have to get on with all that stuff. That said, I think the public outreach aspect of technology ethics is really important. It cannot just be experts talking to experts or people in very rarefied circles talking to one another. It has to absolutely be out in the community. The Ada Lovelace Institute actually has done a great job on that. They've really done a lot of citizen engagement And I'm sure universities are working on that as well. So again, it's early days. It's, you know, it's easy to be like, oh, this isn't happening. It is happening. There's all sorts of really promising signs. It's just about like going big on it so that, you know, it's in schools as part of data literacy and digital literacy. It's something parents are aware of, teachers are aware of, local government is aware of. You know, do we really want to have all of the CCT cameras all around London? Like half of them, even more of them, are all from Hikvision, which is a company that's banned by the US government for national security reasons due to fears from China, but that the UK has just bought. You know, what's our local authority's position on that, right? And they may not have had the need to have a position on that 5 or 10 years ago, but they do now. And so does Parliament, of course.
It's been a really interesting conversation. And I just want to ask you one more broad question, if I may. We've kind of mentioned a lot of these along the way, but what do you think we need to do as a society generally, that could be in terms of education or to ensure that the rise of AI happens in the right way? I mean, it's already started, but we've got a long way still to go.
I mean, I guess I would say, you know, go slowly and mindfully and intentionally. This is not a technology that you want to say, move fast and break things. I think we've all gotten a bit wiser about that and thought, no, the things that got broken were actually really precious and important, and we need to proceed with care. And the second would be democratizing it. And that's what I mean by saying the people who are on the receiving end of technology need to be much more part of the consideration from end to end, you know, from idea to execution. They can't just, it shouldn't be that we only hear from people who are on the receiving end of technology after that technology has been released and these people are now suffering. You know, you don't beta test in real time on entire populations with something like AI. That's just not okay. So democratizing it and slowing it down, I think would be two good starts. And it has to be part of our education. Every citizen and worker is going to have to know about this, right? Like that's where this is tracking. If you want to look at, this is a generational project. The next 5, 10, 15, 20, even 30 years, technology is going to be such a huge part of our lives, not just AI, all of it. What is our plan as a country to be ready for that and to equip all of us to be able to, you know, be good actors in this rather than bad or just kind of a cog in someone else's machine?
That's a really positive and empowering note to end on. Thanks so much for speaking to me today, Stephanie.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to leave a like and a review and to share the episode with friends or anyone who might be interested, and to check out our Twitter at EthicsTechPod and our Instagram at EthicsForAChangingWorld. We have lots of episodes that you can have a listen to that we've already published and lots more coming out. We especially have one which you might enjoy on facial recognition, which we recorded with Ada Lovelace researcher Harry Farmer a couple of months ago. I'll see you again next time.